Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Mona Segetolaslami, and today we have the opportunity to meet an individual who plays an important part in the world of music. Jeff Nelson is a French horn performer and teacher from Canada who joined the IU Jacobs School of Music faculty last year. Nelson was a member of the world-renowned brass quintet, the Canadian Brass, from 2000 to 2004. He also has performed as a soloist and in orchestras around the world, and he also plays on Broadway. Nelson is also working on a book titled Fearless Auditioning. Jeff Nelson, welcome to Profiles. It's a pleasure to have you with us today.
It's great to be here.
So I was wondering, you came from quite a musical family, I've heard, and so can you tell us about how music influenced you growing up and how you came to music?
Sure. It's an interesting story because I grew up on a pig farm. So I had opera singing, pig farming parents, which makes sense. I'm sure they all have opera going on in the farm. That was basically, my father grew up on the farm and my mom grew up in Toronto. The farm was in Western Canada. And he got a scholarship to go study singing in Toronto and met my mom, and they toured around for a while doing things with the Canadian Opera Company, and I think they did HMS Pinafore on Broadway and things like that. They got married and just realized that there wasn't a lot of stability being artists, so they moved back west, back to the pig farm, and started having a family and had my two older sisters, who are both musicians as well. And then I was growing up at the same time and just, you know, decided I had the music around all the time. So that's how I was surrounded by music, you know.
So when did you start on the horn?
I was 12, and it came time for me to pick my instrument. And we were all playing piano growing up as well, but my sister told me that it played the theme for Little House on the Prairie, and it sounded really great. And so I thought, oh, I want to play that. So I played that.
So were there any other careers you considered, you know, if not a musician, you would be a...
At this point, probably a magician, I think. That's one of my hobbies, one of the other things I'm passionate about. But I thought about everything from being a chef and a pilot. And the good thing, I think one of the best things about my success is that I quit horn for 3 years. So I considered other things and kind of had quite a... I built a life away from music, and that helped me not identify my self-worth with being a musician. I didn't have to succeed. I didn't spend my whole life thinking I needed to be a musician. So when I came back to it years later, I could play badly and not feel like a bad person. So I played really badly and discovered really quickly how to get better, a lot easier. I did what I couldn't do and just dove in, got dirty, got into the mess and cleaned it up. And here I am. So that served me really well, I think, with looking at music and other careers as well, you know. And I also, when I teach, I tell people to have a big life. And my first question for my new students is, what do you do away from the horn? You know, what do you like? What else do you like? What do you bring to the stories you tell with your instrument from your life, you know, from other things? You know?
So what was your path then to becoming a professional musician after taking up the horn at 12?
Playing for 3 years and having some great experiences and then quitting, doing sports and doing those other things. And then I took a year off from school, and then the next year I was in school just in general arts. Fell in love, had a girlfriend, didn't go to class, and was put on probation. So I thought, well, maybe I'll go back into music. It was kind of my way to stay in school. And did that for a year, and the music department wasn't that great at the school I was at in Western Canada. So I was going to quit again, become a teacher. I really respected my teachers at that point. And my sister was going to McGill University in Montreal. And she said, well, audition for McGill. So I auditioned there and I told myself if I got in, I'd go. And I got in. So I moved to Montreal and studied there for 3 years. And in my third year, I did an audition for the Winnipeg Symphony and won that audition and left school. and moved out to Winnipeg for a year and froze. It was very cold, so that inspired me to practice even more. And there was an audition for the Montreal Symphony, which is one of the top orchestras in the world and very prolifically recorded and really great orchestra. And it was always my sister's favorite orchestra as well, so I had extra inspiration to revere that orchestra, I guess. That was when I also really developed, I really wanted that job, so that was when I developed all the things that are going into my book. It's actually called Fearless Auditioning, so it's about that auditioning process and all the mental gymnastics that it takes to succeed, as well as the athletic things we do on our instruments, combining those. And I had to figure that out in order to ensure that when I walk in there, I win that job. And I won that audition in 2 rounds, actually. They didn't even have a final round. I was overprepared. And then so I was back in Montreal teaching at McGill as well, teaching people that were in my class, which was kind of fun. Yeah, so that was the beginnings.
And you mentioned the importance of having a hobby. So can you tell us about your hobby, magic?
It's pretty close to, I mean, it's identical to music, much like athletes and that training and all the things we do on our own and how we research things and try and develop excellence in that area. Magic's the same thing. You just sit in a room and you practice it and you practice and practice. And then the ultimate reward is performing, in the same as an athlete. You know, you have a race that doesn't matter what you've done before. It's what you do in that race. And magic's the same, where you perform, except you get to watch the eyes light up and, you know, do it for kids and things. And that's a really great thing. And all the touring with Canadian Brass and all the playing I did in the pit facilitated learning a lot of sleights of hand during my bar's rest and just on the planes. And I just sit next to someone and go, hey, you want to see a card trick? And everybody's like, yeah, sure. So you have a built-in audience everywhere you go. People, a very captive audience on a plane. I love the pursuit of it and telling a story. And you know, it's a great art.
How did you get started on magic?
My mom's cousin lives in California, and so we'd go down and visit them sometimes. I grew up, the pig farm was just 10 miles north of Edmonton, Alberta. So we'd get in the camper and drive down to California, and my mother's cousin's son was into magic. His name was Carl, and he did a magic show for us once, and it blew my mind. I was getting 11 or 12, and then the next day we went to Disneyland, and I was in the magic store for hours and hours, just, okay, do that one. I still have the first trick I got in Disneyland, this little rainbow rod trick. And so I just was so amazed by it. And it's just close-up magic coins, cards, and things like that. You can have it anywhere you go. And it's been a great, and it's a community, much like the music community. You know, there's a magic castle in LA that I ended up at when I was on a Andrew Lloyd Webber tour, and just was there every night for 2 weeks. And you go into the house up on the hill, and you say, you know, the party for four, Nelson, and they say, okay, go to the bookcase and say the magic words. You go to the bookcase and you say, open sesame, and the little statue of the owl, the eyes flash red, and then the bookcase opens, and that's the beginning of your night. You walk into the magic castle. So I've already told my wife that we need that in our basement. We're going to have a secret bookcase where you say, open sesame, and you go in and we can do magic.
Let's take a break here. We have several selections from recordings you've made. And can you tell us about this music, this quintet by Michael Kamen?
Yes, it's a really beautiful piece, as you will hear. And Michael Kamen wrote over 70 movie soundtracks, all the Die Hard movies and all the Lethal Weapon soundtracks, Mr. Holland's Opus, 101 Dalmatians, a bunch of things like that. And he wrote this for Canadian Brass. It's just really beautiful. Shows off the horn quite beautifully, and nice soaring melodies. And we also, it was on the CD that featured me quite a bit, called The Magic Horn. And on the CD is also the video that we did, Rhombus Media, the company that did Red Violin and some other beautiful art films and things, made this beautiful video of it as well. And we're in a quarry, and at the end I'm standing a couple hundred feet up on a cliff, you know, playing the last few notes, and it's really, really cool. Thank you.
That was a quintet by Michael Kamen, performed by our guest Jeff Nelson with the Canadian Brass. I was wondering if you could describe for us one of your favorite performing experiences and what made it so great.
One of the moments I very strongly remember learning a lot about fearlessness and losing your ego on stage was Canadian Brass performed a concert right around 9/11. Our last encore, we spoke about 9/11, and then we asked for no applause at the end, and we played Barber's Adagio for strings, and it was arranged for the quintet. And it starts with horn standing out front all alone, and dim the lights, and sometimes it's just a spotlight on me. And then as the piece grows, each of the brass players' bells turn and face the audience. They start facing across the stage toward me, and so there's a lot of attention on the hornist standing out there. And then the horn has a lot of the melodies, and it features the horn a lot. Me, 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 you know, and a lot of times as a performer, you get into thinking that, you know, and I hope I play this well, and I want to do this. But this performance, Chuck, the tuba player, spoke about 9/11 and spoke about what kind of tribute we wanted to do and walked out there. And the next thing I knew, we were off stage and it was over, and I didn't exist on the stage. Everything disappeared except for the music and just things larger than me and my ego and and the group and everything like that. And walked off stage in silence and in darkness as well, which is really powerful. And then afterwards, got a lot of comments that was the best they'd heard me play and all that, you know, and it was really, and I had no idea what I had done out there. It was just all about greater things, and so I use that a lot in my teaching and talking to people about get over yourself. It's not about you, it's about your melody and the music and the sentiments and the composer's gifts, and knowing that that audience wants to just enjoy beautiful music, all those things, you know, instead. So it was a really powerful moment. That's probably one of my favorite experiences in performance.
You've also performed with a number of famous artists and were from all different genres of music. Are there any performers you really enjoyed meeting or working with? Maybe someone surprising to you?
Not really. One thing that serves me pretty well is I try not to decide what's going to happen when I go in. So I'm usually not surprised because I try and think the best of the people. I'm surprised when they're not great people, you know, a lot of the time. But I just remember, most of the people I've worked with have been really, really great. The surprising moment was one performer. He performs for children all the time, very famous, well-known person. And I just remember in rehearsal, there was a children's choir, and I remember him yelling at the kids, telling them to stop singing and that they were going to use a recording. And he's a child performer that was one of the surprising moments where he wasn't all that fond of the children that he got famous for performing for. Anyway, but aside from that, no. I mean, I love all the people I've worked with. It's just been really, really great, right? When I talk to kids and do lectures at high schools and things like that, and younger people, the first thing I say is that there is work in the music world, and it is an enjoyable life, regardless of how many people say you don't want a life as a musician. And that's what, you know, helped me quit for those years, but I'm glad I came back to it. And I tell them that I have a Xbox 360, a PS3, and a Wii, and a big TV. And if you want all these things, I got these things through playing music. And that usually gets their attention, and I have them for a little while. But then I get to, you know, I played basketball and laser tag with Michael Bolton and, you know, just and I played Madison Square Garden with Barry Manilow and things. And I can say that, you know, Phil Myers, who's the principal horn in the New York Philharmonic and one of my horn gods, he's a very good friend. I can say that. It blows my mind. I don't pinch myself. I haven't pinched myself since the first $5 I made as a musician, but it's been in a really... Phil Myers came here 2 weeks ago to do a masterclass. He was doing a concert nearby, and he came by and we performed together. We played a Haydn double concerto to start this 3-hour masterclass that he did. It was a definite lifetime highlight. I got to play double quintets with all the principal brass in the New York Philharmonic every Christmas with Canadian Brass. And we got to go to Japan every year and Germany and kind of all over the world. And the best thing is just to have those incredible appreciative audiences. Canadian Brass audiences, there's nothing better. And they're non-musicians, so they come to just, you know, enjoy and not judge and critique and do all that, you know. It's really amazing.
So could you tell us more about your experience as a member of Canadian Brass, I guess both about being a member of the group and more, I guess, experience of performing?
It was a dream. It was really amazing. And being a Canadian as well, it was, well, I guess any brass player knows about the Canadian Brass and things, but to play in that group, you go out there most of the time for full houses, a few thousand people, and one of the best things is that you get to use that laboratory every night, you know, and 150 concerts a year, and you just go out and try things and go, okay, I want to try this tonight, and you can walk off stage going, okay, that didn't work, you know, and go do something else the next night and really keep experimenting in performance. So it was a great learning experience, especially, and for my teaching now, you know, how much I learned on the fact that the audience knows everything you're thinking. And it's not, so that's not an opportunity for more fear and more pressure. It's an opportunity to, okay, great, I got to clean up what I'm thinking, come out there and think the best of my audience, get out there, and regardless of what they're thinking and what you know, if Billy's out there wanting you to miss a note, take them off your radar and just play to the people that, you know, are appreciating what you're doing and get out there and just experiment and, you know, keep building on your strengths, you know. Yeah, it's been really great. One of the other things I learned, I went basically from Fourthorn in the Vancouver Symphony and into Canadian Brass as far as, but I had won the principal job prior and was runner-up for Chicago and L.A. Symphonies, L.A. Philharmonic. So I was doing well around that situation. But going from sitting in the back of the orchestra to standing in front of the Canadian Brass literally 2 weeks later was quite a trip. So baptism by fire, which was really, really great. And went out my first concert in Dallas and clipped a few notes and, you know, was out in the lobby afterwards signing autographs and on all the CDs and stuff. And people were complimenting me and I was like, oh, thanks, you know, but still being modest and making myself smaller and things, not to be a braggart, you know, rather go the other way. And I learned really quickly that I saw one person's face kind of go, oh, you know, when they complimented me, I said, oh, thanks, you know, and they looked at me kind of a little disappointed that I wasn't happy with my performance. And then I learned in that moment that their compliment is just their opinion, and I have to accept that. Otherwise, it ruins that connection and that communication moment that they're sharing with me. You know, it's their opinion, and that's something else I make my students do, is that they have to accept all compliments that they're given, because it's that person's opinion for, you know, that they enjoyed it. It's, you know, we know all the notes we missed, but that's for the practice room and for off stage.
So then also, what was, I guess, Canadian Brass like practice room with a regular chamber group that you're always playing with? Did you enjoy that experience?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was great. We rehearsed in a big church all the time, and just kind of whenever we were not on tour, we were centered in Toronto. So we'd meet up at Starbucks and talk about a lot of the business stuff for half an hour or more, upcoming recordings or tours or projects. And there were always 10 times more projects than what we had time for. And we'd talk about all the things, what's going on here and there. And then we'd go in and probably rehearse from 10 till 1, 10 till 12:30 or 1 or something, go for lunch somewhere and come back and play from 1:30 to 4 or 5. And it was really great. And we just play and play and play and run programs and then try music that was sent to us and talk about what would be great projects and what's going, you know, and try and really break ground for the brass world and the music world. You know, they're real ambassadors to creating a lot of the new music for brass chamber music. You know, they've had hundreds of new works commissioned and things like that, contemporary works, and as well as the things they're probably more famous for with all the arrangements and the pop music and the Beatles and things like that.
I guess also you've played on Broadway, and can you tell me about your experience being on Broadway and what shows you've played in and what you like about it?
I love Broadway. It was really, really great. I had a bunch of really good friends that loved those tunes. And whenever Canadian Brass came through New York, my best friend who sang the song that I think you'll hear in a little bit, his name is Adam James, and he's a jazz singer, but he loves these Broadway shows too, so he would take me to see Wicked and Avenue Q, and I was immediately sold. So then when I left the Canadian Brass, I was offered a position with the Chitty Chitty Bang Bang band. So I moved to New York and just started playing in the pit for that show, and it was amazing. It was a bit of a a switch from being on stage one of five people, which is if there's the amount of energy from an audience, if it's shared amongst an orchestra, it's a little bit more diluted than energy toward five people. So you get a lot of energy if there's just five of you. And from that to sitting in a pit and not really being much of a part of the to receive the energy that you're used to on stage was a little bit of a switch, but not too bad because I still loved coming out of the texture when it was right, the right time. And, you know, this is a horn moment and adding to those emotional things, which is way more powerful when there's a story going on and there's lyrics and acting and drama and humor and all these things. I get my kicks from that part of the connection to the audience and live through the performance in that way because I know what the audience is experiencing. There's some funny performance stories come to mind for in that band where Joe Bergstaller, one of the trumpet players with Canadian Brass, and I left the group at the same time. He's gone back to the group and he's performing with them now. But we sat next to each other in the pit. We both played in that band, and I was living with the trombone player at the time as well, and he was behind me, and there was a solo that, you know, every night, and I'm sitting there, and Joe's in my wedding party as well. He's a dear friend, and the solo started, and he stood up really quickly. I didn't know why until I felt him put a rope around me and pass the rope to the trombone player behind me, and they proceeded to tie me to my chair really, really tightly while I'm playing, and they knew I couldn't stop playing, so they kept tying me to this chair, and you know, the whole orchestra's watching and laughing. This is, you know, 5 months in, so they know that we are taking it seriously, and we're nailing what the audience experiences. I mean, they can't see this going on. And I played the solo fine. And then another 10 minutes later, there's another solo where I just have to play da-da or something like that. And as soon as I start playing, Joe stands up again. And when you hold the French horn, your right hand is just in the bell, and it's sitting there. So it's not all that functional. I mean, it is, but if I'm holding a note, I can make it work. And Joe knew this, so he took the rope and tied it around my right hand and tied my right hand to the chair during that solo. So just my elbow. So it made turning pages very difficult if you're holding a horn with your left hand and your right hand is tied to your chair. So that was quite entertaining for the rest of the first half. And then also me receiving my visitors because I was tied to the chair during the intermission as well. It was anyway, it was very fun. Another time I tied the percussionist behind me, who I loved giving grief to, and he's in the show I'm playing now called The Pirate Queen as well. So I have him as a target for my upcoming playing on Broadway. He plays the bass drum and the cymbals behind me, and he basically has to look past me to the conductor. So he's looking, and we found out that he was scared of spiders. So I tied a spider with black thread up and through the ceiling and down so it could come down right in front of him. And there was a part where he was playing and the spider was going down and I was letting it down with my right hand that was just sitting in the bell. And I'm watching him and the spider came down, got stuck right in front of his face. And just as he was looking curiously, trying to figure out what it was, the thread let loose a bit and it slipped down about an inch and his eyes exploded and he almost dropped the cymbal, but he stopped playing. It was very entertaining. I don't recommend doing that, though, in orchestral concerts for our IU students. This is only for in the pit. Conduct. So save it for the opera.
So let's hear another one of your recordings about the music by Mozart, but you've added your own personal touch. Can you tell us about this?
Sure. This is the Rondo from the Mozart Horn Quintet, written for horn and a string quartet. And the string quartet has two violas, violin and cello. Interesting instrumentation. And this was arranged by Freddie Mills, one of the other former Canadian Brass trumpet players. And there's a little moment for a few notes played alone, but the guys in the group said, okay, well, why don't you just show off there, do something, you know, write a cadenza there and, you know, show what you can do. So that's kind of what I did. I also, my sister is a bassoonist. She plays with the Boston Symphony, and she married Dave Ohanian, one of the former Canadian Brass horn players, which is kind of a weird incestuous horn thing that David is my brother-in-law, and Jamie Somerville, who's the principal horn in the Boston Symphony, he's my distant cousin as well. So we have a horn mob in the family. But she plays bassoon, and I quote the Mozart bassoon concerto for her in the cadenza as well. It's just a fun cadenza. ¶¶
The rondo for Mozart's horn quintet K407, performed by Canadian Brass, with our guest Jeff Nelson, who also wrote the cadenza. Can you tell us about when you first started teaching?
I guess it would be when I was at McGill University. I was teaching at the conservatory first, teaching young kids that would come in to study the horn. So this is back in 1991. And then I came back and was teaching at McGill in 1994. So that's when I first started. I guess I've been on 5 different Canadian university faculties. Whenever I was in that city playing with our orchestra, I joined the faculty. And coming to IU is the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. It's just amazing. It's fantastic.
Is there any way that teaching has changed your approach to your instrument or how you view your own performing?
In every way, it's very holistic how my study of succeeding at performing evolves my teaching, and my teaching helps my performing evolve just in every way. It changes everything, and I can do things now that I couldn't do 4 months ago from all the teaching that I've done. This is the most intensive amount of teaching I've done. 18 students, 6 chamber music groups every week. The chamber music groups is a little less intense, but still those 18 students, and just having to diagnose and explain and make 18 different unique plans of training on your path to excellence and success in life and in horn playing and music making. It's in every way it changes my performing and the way I live too, because I want to be a good example for them and inspire them in the people that they are, because the person they are is what walks out on that stage. So if you're worried about how you treated your friend 5 minutes ago when you're on stage, then you can either learn to forget about how you treated your friend, or you can treat your friend better next time, and and I try not to judge either, because sometimes I don't treat my friends optimally too. So it's great. It's a sharing of these lessons, you know.
Can you tell us more about your approach to teaching?
The teachers that I remember most fondly and probably helped me the most, I believe, were the ones that their teaching philosophies were that it was always about what to do. And they always said, okay, great, now do this. Okay, now do this over here. You know, and they kind of kept me being this stumbling fool towards excellence, you know, and I call it idiot-proofing the student or the performer or myself, you know, and they would always go, okay, now come over here. And because I think I've missed every note I've told myself not to miss. In my mind, if I say, don't miss, but another approach is make this note beautiful. And that has way more successful, higher success rate approaching things in that way, what to do. When I lecture about this, I tell the audience, it's always about what to do. And I say, okay, everybody right now, don't think of the color green. Don't think green, not green. Anything but green. Don't think green. And they do what you do. They just close their eyes and try and try. And then I say, okay, now just think of the color yellow. Great. You're immediately not thinking green, but you don't need to know what you're not thinking about. You're also not thinking about it if it rained yesterday and when your mother's birthday. There's a billion things you're not thinking about. So just think about the thing to do. And, that really helps get to success a lot quicker. And all the analysis, worthwhile as it may be, I think more often than not, the analysis of what's going wrong, a lot of the time could be wasted time that could be spent refining what to do instead of figuring out what's wrong. Just get to what to do. And a lot of times, there is value in doing that at times, but I think there's also great value in just getting on the cure or the remedy or the thing that makes it better.
And you've mentioned enjoying coming here to IU Bloomington and to the Jacobs School of Music. Can you tell us, what was it like both coming to the school and also coming to the U.S. from Canada, about the change in how things are?
Coming to the school was really great. It's bigger than any school I've ever seen. Being from Canada, we have less people than bigger country, but smaller schools. So it was just blew my mind. It was so impressive and so great, and everybody here was really great. I actually just watched some of the video of when I came last February and did a master class, and it was really neat to watch. And I remembered what I thought being in the Indiana University School, Jacobs School of Music. I've been hearing about for years and years, and so many people I performed with went here, and very impressive. The faculty is second to none in the world. and the students as well. It's just a fantastic level here. The library, music library, everything. It's just so impressive. The programs, the amount of orchestras, and the quality that it works at. And so I felt very lucky and happy with myself that I pursue things aggressively, and anything I really want, I make sure I do everything I possibly can to be ready so that I ensure I get what I want. And luckily, I did that before getting here, because if I hadn't, and I got here and fell in love with this place as much as I did when I got here, and I hadn't done the preparation, I would definitely would have been my biggest regret. So I was really happy that I was ready to go when I got here, and just, you know, presented myself well, and it worked out that they invited me to come and invited me to stay, and I am staying. My wife and I looked for a house last week and had a lot of fun doing that, so it's a perfect place for us to have a family and settle here, I think. And because I grew up on a pig farm and moved here from New York, this is right in the middle of those two things. It's really, it's got the city thing, but it's also got the farm potential to leave town easily and get out into the nature, you know. So I love it. Coming here from Canada, I spent a lot of time in America. I did an 8-month tour of an Andrew Lloyd Webber tour in 96, 35 cities in 35 weeks. And so just 8 shows a week, played in Vegas and Nashville and LA and Florida and all over. So I know the, and then Canadian Brass, we, you know, 70% of our touring was in the States. So it wasn't that big of a culture shock being here, you know.
I guess it connects with teaching, but will you tell us about your new book or the book that you're working on, Fearless Auditioning?
Sure. It's called Fearless Auditioning, and it started with an article I started writing for Canadian Brass, and I was looking back and thinking basically that I had never been 100% confident. I've gone into things going, I'm confident, but I've never been 100% confident. Whereas I've looked back on a few moments and I was 100% fearless, and much like that 9/11 concert where I didn't exist, there was no fear at all. And so that was an ultimate state of complete fearlessness. And in the article, I then wrote about how children, I don't think, are confident. I think they're fearless. I think, you know, they don't, okay, I got to get confident to go get that cookie. You know, they just go get it. You know, and I think that's a great way to be on stage, that you're just out there sharing your music, you know, and just playing out there. That fearlessness, I'm sorry to have to mention, is only, the mental state is only 50%, that being fearless alone doesn't do much if you haven't done the training and the preparation. So sorry, but we also have to practice and do all that other study as well. But that fearless state, I think, serves us really well. It gets the mental clutter out of the way, so we can focus on fewer priorities and have them stronger in our minds. And for an audition, you can train for, you know, weeks, months, years, and you get 5 minutes to go in there and strut your stuff. And if it doesn't go well, those, you have to go back and keep doing it. And I've learned that to do my very best, I have to be on my game mentally at this stage. Basically, if you're doing a professional audition, you know what your fingerings are, you know what a 16th note looks like and what it should sound like, and you know all those things. You've learned your instrument, so now it's about manifesting that in a potentially pressure-filled situation. And so my fearlessness book is all about training yourself to have fearless habits. Our bodies don't discern between good and bad habits. We just learn habits. So, again, that's not pressure to fear. That's you know, an opportunity to clean up our habits and make them good ones. So thinking constructively and optimally when you go in to perform helps with that in a great deal in my experience. And my career shows that well, at least that I'm living proof of that. So the book is filled with fearlessness tools, ways to think about things and what to do. I have a motivational sheet that I read before going out for auditions and things, and they just remind me of things that clear my mind and ready myself for success. Like, they want you to play well. You're just reminding me of these things. They want you to play well. Be the most musical. Don't ask, tell. All these kinds of things. You know, make the decision easy for them. I want them to, right from the very first note, you know, say, wow, okay, we want to hire that person, you know, and we just have to discuss if that person doesn't take the job, who are we going to hire next? That's, you know, but just make the decision. So easy for them to love what they're hearing when I'm playing. You know, do tons of mock auditions and things like that. The motivational sheet for auditions I read before walking into the room, and then I walk those 10 seconds to the stand, and then I take the sheet out and I glance at those sayings again, because even in those 10 seconds, there's opportunity to find some sort of thing that I can doubt myself or fear or something. I'm that well trained, and I think we all are to a degree, to fear and to doubt and things, and find, okay, what could go wrong? You know, so then I read it again. You know, every excerpt is the only excerpt. This is all I'm going to play. It's this one excerpt. Play this one, and you know, ultimately, and then go to play the next excerpt. Look at the motivational sheet again. That clears it up. And now this is the only excerpt I'm playing for them. I don't have to recover from playing badly or live up to playing better than I think I can play. All that stuff. And just those are some ways for me to stumble down a path of excellence. And then the thing I don't control is success. Other people a lot of times decide if I'm going to win the audition. You know, that's up to them. But usually a lot of times it works out.
And so how has the experience of sharing this with other people been for you?
From what I can tell, from what people are saying to me, I think it's going pretty well. I think it's a lot of people that I talk about this to really, really enjoy it. And in my opinion, you know, I can only guess, but yeah, the feedback has been very positive in my experience. Yeah. And it's really, this is what makes me really easily, gladly say that being at IU is the greatest fulfilling thing I've ever done, except for marrying my wife. So just being here and watching my students thrive and succeed and play better and grow and get better and enjoy what I'm teaching and what I'm sharing, as well as learning from them too. It's so fulfilling. Teaching for me is the ultimate fulfilling thing, because as a performer I can perform. And I remember watching, I think the movie was Patch Adams, and it's about, he was a doctor and he was helping out, and I remember just being blown away by the moments in the movie, and I'm sitting there crying about this huge powerful moment about the state of the planet and, you know, these things, and then I was thinking, geez, and I'm just doing music. Why can't I contribute to the world better? And I should be doing something with medicine or something that contributes more. And I'm crying away. I'm hearing the rest of the theater sob away. And then I think, would this theater be moved as much with this moment without the music that's playing in this movie? So I've never doubted that ever again, that music contributes equally to the world, you know, I believe. So all the performing that I did was very fulfilling and really great in the moment. And after the performance and the inspiration that gave people and the break from what's going on in the world and the nice, you know, to smile here and there, take a break. It lived on for a little while and it may inspire people for a while, but not as much as teaching. I think you can really, I see contributing as a teacher to contribute even more, and really, you know, that sends ripples a little bit further. And I love having a longer lasting impact on that as well. And I still get to perform and do that. And I'm in no way reducing the impact of performing. Well, just this is just my opinion on the teaching part and how much joy that brings me and how fulfilling that is. But I get to go away on the weekends sometimes and do some performing as well. You know. It's a dream. It's perfect.
So let's hear some more music. This piece is an interesting selection with personal meaning for you. And can you tell us about this song?
This is a piece called I Found You. And basically I wrote the lyrics to the slow movement to the Barber Violin Concerto. And it has personal meaning because I played the piece, the Barber Violin Concerto, for my trial week with the Vancouver Symphony, and I just got to know it inside out to make sure I did well on my trial week. And so I just fell in love with the melody that the oboe plays at the beginning, and just, oh, it's so amazing. And then I met my now wife, Nina, and she got her bachelor's on violin before going into voice, and she's now an opera singer. A beautiful mezzo-soprano. So she played the Barber Violin Concerto on her last recital as a violinist before going into singing. So we connected immediately on that piece, and wow, love that piece. So we listened to it a lot, and she had never had a song written for her, and I would write lyrics at times. And so I wrote these lyrics to this piece. And the I found you part comes from Nina remembering the first time I said I love you to her. I said, I found you. I was single for a long time. And, you know, so that was what I was feeling, falling in love with her. It is Joshua Bell, a local here. I used his recording with the Baltimore Symphony in the background. And it's my best friend who was the best man at my wedding singing. His name is Adam James. And I added some French horn at the beginning and at the end, and I edited it so it flows pretty much like a good pop tune. And Adam's going to put it on his next album, I think, as well. And the first time Nina heard it was at the wedding, and it was our first dance. And it was pretty amazing. And when the climax happens out of nowhere, it was an outdoor wedding in California. She's from Santa Barbara. And this gust of wind starts swirling around us, and there's white linen curtains all around the dance floor outside, and they started blowing in the breeze during the climax. And it was a pretty magical moment. It was really, really great.
I Have Found You. The lyrics were written by our guest Jeff Nelson, and it's sung with a recording of the Barber Violin Concerto. And that brings us to the conclusion of this interview. Our guest was horn player and IU Jacobs School of Music professor Jeff Nelson. Jeff Nelson, thank you for spending time with us today and for sharing your thoughts with our WFIU audience.
Pleasure.
I'm Mona Segetolasamy, and thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in April of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.